Hello, I'm Lina Khmudu. Welcome to Health Chat. On the program today, we will look at the challenges and solutions of access to accurate and quality medical diagnosis. But first, Egypt is said to become one of the first countries in the world to be declared free of hepatitis C, according to a World Health Organization official. Dr. Naima Al-Kassir, the WHO's representative for Egypt, says the North African nation has submitted papers declaring it free of the disease, and an announcement will be made by the Geneva-based health organization in the coming weeks, Egypt's official news agency reported. Dr. Al-Kassir says Egypt has worked extensively and intensively to become free of hepatitis C through a presidential initiative known as 100 Million Healthy Lives, which has received global praise. Now, turning to diagnosis, during the World Health Assembly held this past May in Geneva, stakeholders in global health passed a resolution on strengthening diagnostics capacity. Observers say it is a significant step towards improving access to quality and accurate diagnostic tests and strengthening diagnostic services in low- and middle-income countries. But they say more needs to be done to ensure better access to quality diagnostic tools and expertise. For more on the subject, I spoke with Neha Agarwal, Global Program Co-Lead, Diagnostics at PATH, an international nonprofit global health organization. Take a listen.
Unfortunately, the latest reports indicate that over half the world's population actually don't have access to quality diagnostics. And if we look at that number specifically in low and middle income countries, it actually only drops to 20%. What does that mean? That means 4 out of 5 individuals who go seek care don't have access to appropriate diagnostics. And what does this mean? If you think about it from a health guiding principle perspective, if you don't have the correct diagnosis, you likely don't know what is ailing you, which means that clinical care pathways will not necessarily be appropriate given your condition. The other side of it is looking at it from the patient perspective, which is, you know, whenever a patient comes to visit a health clinic, it is a huge gift to the health system, whether that's the private sector health system or the public health system. And we really need to be able to honor the fact that somebody is coming to seek care. And when they come to seek care and we're unable to provide them with the appropriate tools and the appropriate information to guide their clinical care, it is going to be very difficult to establish trust with that individual, and it will be very difficult for that individual to have confidence in the health system, which means that there will likely be a loss to follow-up, there will likely be a lack of an incentive to come back the next time they are feeling ill or sick, or their child is ill or sick, and so the whole system becomes a downward spiral. So diagnostics are really a underappreciated tool to build trust and confidence in the health system.
You recently attended the World Health Assembly where a resolution on strengthening diagnostics capacity was passed. What are your thoughts on the resolution?
The resolution was a very welcome policy from our perspective. As I mentioned, diagnostics have historically been underappreciated, underutilized, and underfunded. The diagnostic community is very excited that we now have a piece of policy and a resolution that for the first time really carves out the role that diagnostics play in reaching universal health coverage. And that role will help really mobilize the coordination and the catalyzing of funding to support the diagnostic resolution and its implementation. So yes, it's a first step, the first step of many, but it is much needed and really can help mobilize the community and create advocacy around the importance of diagnostics.
When you look at the landscape of diagnosis, what would you say are the pressing needs?
So it's a great question. And, you know, similar to your first question, the resolution itself will really be the starting point and sort of the platform by which various implementing partners, donors, normative agencies will build their diagnostic programs. I think first and foremost, we need to really invest in workforce strengthening. So you can have the tools on the shelves, but until you have trained health professionals who know how to use them, know when to use them, and know how to report the data, the tool itself will not solve any of the problems. And so there does need to be sort of a coordinated effort to look at trained capacity and ensuring that that capacity is right-sized and allocated and dispersed where appropriate. So for example, it doesn't make sense if all of the workforce capacity is centralized at a tertiary facility. So we really need to meet the patients where they are. And that might be at primary health clinics, in the community itself, and in many cases, in the households themselves. And one of the great changes that we saw during COVID was, especially in the Western world, was a huge utilization of self-testing. For various reasons, we did not see the same access to self-testing in low and middle income countries, which is a huge tragedy coming out of COVID. But what we learned is that there is appetite and that patients can themselves take control of their health. And so that is a very great way to sort of democratize health and task shift who is appropriately able and capable of managing their own health.
Some people say that a resolution is a step in the right direction, but it is not enough to address the issue of equitable access. You did touch on it already, but what other priorities need urgent attention to improve access to diagnostics?
One of the things that we've really learned, especially in the past 3 years of COVID, is when you have diagnostic supply, you have to look at what the markets look like when we are in sort of a normal status quo situation, and when are we in an emergency situation such as COVID, such as the one that COVID put us in. When COVID hit, all of our reliance on exports and imports from other Western countries really sabotaged access. And so one of the things that the diagnostic community is really putting some momentum behind is this idea of local manufacturing, local to the African continent, local to other regions. And there is a lot of emphasis on how the localization of diagnostic supply will directly improve access to diagnostics. And there's many sort of side effects thinking about what localization can do. One of the things that we've seen in our own research is the fact that diagnostic manufacturers who are based in low and middle income countries, their product portfolio is actually more attuned to the local populations and the local diseases and health needs of those populations. And so when we think about what does diagnostic access look like in 5 to 10 years, we believe that local innovation should solve and fill the needs for local health priorities. And so this is one of the areas that we're really excited about. There's already a lot of work being done. And I think this year and next year, thanks in part to the resolution, we'll see more and more investments into local companies.
So how much of the resolution will support countries to prioritize investment in systems and resources needed to ensure everyone who needs a medical test can get one?
One of the key priorities in the resolution is actually requesting that countries develop their own national diagnostic strategies. And as part of that, looking at developing essential diagnostics lists. And what that means is at a country level, there should be some signals in terms of where the country and the Ministry of Health see the disease and health priorities. And unfortunately, the truth of life is that there are always budget constraints when it comes to public health. But this way, sort of looking at the budget constraints and understanding what is feasible, actually prioritizing the diagnostics that are immediately needed, and being able to signal to manufacturers, to clinics, that these are the top priorities for a particular MOH. That alone will help coordinate and help catalyze coordination across many different partners to ensure that a country's needs are really being met. At a very high level, without the national priorities being dictated by the governments of these countries themselves, it is inevitable that somebody else will dictate those priorities for them. And so it's really critical that countries be able to voice their own opinions and prioritize their own needs. And a great way to do that is through the development of the national diagnostic strategies.
And before we wrap, to what extent does improving access to diagnostics help move the needle when it comes to universal health coverage as a whole?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And I love that you're linking the access to diagnostics directly to reaching universal health coverage. For me and for many of the colleagues in my diagnostic community, we see the direct linkage. Without having appropriate access to diagnostics, we will not be able to appropriately guide a patient's clinical pathway. And without diagnosing in the very beginning stages of that cascade, we will not know what the disease burden of patients and communities are around the world. We will not know who is accessing care. We will not know what their appropriate follow-up should look like. And so we see diagnostics as really the door, the first step in involving and having patients participate in the health system and really opening the door to universal health coverage.
Go ahead, please continue.
I was just going to end on a note to say, you know, diagnostics is really that first touch point that a healthcare system has with a patient. And again, if we're able to demonstrate that at a government and even a private level, when a patient comes to seek care, we have the tools and the resources to appropriately guide their clinical pathway, we will undoubtedly see an uptake in accessing facilities and accessing care. So that alone will help increase the demand for seeking health services and proactively participating in the health system.
Neha Agarwal, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
That was Neha Agarwal, Global Program Co-Lead for Diagnostics with PATH.
This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
In a unique approach for early diagnosis, personal health monitoring is coming to the most private of places, the toilet. Matt Dibble looks at new devices that track human waste.
Each day, vast amounts of valuable health information are flushed down toilets. Stanford School of Medicine's Sungmin Park says there is an opportunity to improve health by closely monitoring human waste.
Here's a prototype that we work on.
Park is developing a smart toilet that can gather visual information about a user's stool and send it to healthcare providers.
And we're looking at those excreta with computer vision and artificial intelligence to tell
the early disease detection or even prevention of disease.
The camera is located right behind this housing here.
Park is working with South Korean manufacturer Ezen to develop the first consumer version, which will be an add-on to an existing toilet, with the capability to send basic health and nutrition advice to a user's phone. Park says future versions could monitor many conditions and even detect early signs of cancer. U-Scan, a device from French company Withings, samples urine.
Urine is an amazing source of health information. Urine contains up to 3,000 chemical compounds.
The system uses replaceable cartridges with enough tests for 90 days.
All you have to do is just to urinate, and that's it.
A tiny pump is heat-activated and delivers drops of urine to a test strip,
which will react with urine and generate a color change, which we detect with an optical sensor.
Test results appear on the app within minutes. Cartridges for monitoring fertility and nutrition will be available first. Tech is coming to the toilet, but it remains to be seen if users are ready to welcome these innovations into their most private routines. Matt Dibble for VOA News, Palo Alto, California.
You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It is time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Health Chat. One of the world's most common artificial sweeteners is said to be declared a possible carcinogen next month by a leading global health body. That's what two sources familiar with the process told Reuters. Take a listen.
Could drinking diet sodas, chewing gum, and eating yogurt lead to cancer? The World Health Organization is set to label aspartame, an artificial sweetener found in these products, a possible cancer risk. But will consumers be willing to kick the habit?
It seems like everything causes cancer these days.
Always knew it kind of like tastes funny.
I'd rather even have sugar instead of aspartame.
Discovered in 1965 by an American chemist and approved by the FDA 9 years later, aspartame is about 200 times sweeter than regular table sugar. It has almost zero calories, so it became popular with increasingly diet-conscious consumers. Shoppers can find it in everything, from Weight Watchers yogurts to some Snapple drinks and Mars's extra chewing gum.
It's convenient for companies to kind of construct what we call a health halo around some of these products.
Noah Pramsma is a nutrition education coordinator with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine.
Unfortunately, in this case, as you dig a little deeper, you realize that sometimes something like a diet soda might not quite be the health food that we might have hoped.
Food companies now need to decide whether to fight back against the labeling, ignore it, or find alternative sweeteners to use. However, recent recipe tweaks by soft drinks giant PepsiCo demonstrate the struggle of balancing health concerns with taste. PepsiCo removed aspartame from sodas in 2015, only to bring it back a year later, and then remove it again in 2020.
You know, the consumer taste is a very, very difficult thing to get right.
Here's Adam Coons, a portfolio manager at Winthrop Capital Management.
We do see, you know, the big soda manufacturers like Pepsi and Coke changing their formula over time. Now, this takes time because you can't just say, hey, we're going to replace one sweetener with another. Taste is what drives the majority of the sales with one manufacturer over another.
Reuters sources say the International Agency for Research on Cancer, an arm of the WHO, will list aspartame as a possible carcinogen in July, putting it in the same category as lead and some pesticides. However, the IARC has two more serious categories, probably carcinogenic and carcinogenic. The latter category includes tobacco and alcohol. Analysts say, like with smoking, it could be a while before a behavior shift is seen.
The consumer will continue to do something that they know is somewhat harmful to their health for quite a while. It takes a big shift. I mean, we saw it in cigarettes. You know, everyone knows that it causes cancer, yet there's still a product, right?
That was Reuters Flora Bradley Watson reporting.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
A Sudanese psychologist and trauma specialist says sexual violence has been rampant in Sudan's conflict, which is in its third month. Sulaima Eshach is also the director of Combating Violence Against Women, a unit within Sudan's Ministry of Social Development. She tells Nabil Biagio young women, immigrant and refugee women, as well as women from African ethnicities, have been particularly targeted with sexual violence in Sudan's conflict. While her unit has documented more than 60 cases of rape and sexual violence, Ishar says that's only a fraction of the actual number.
What we are saying in numbers, it represents only 2% of what's really happening. Because when it comes to gender-based violence and sexual violence related to conflict, we consider all women are located in the zones where conflict are, they are subjected to this kind of violence. Especially that we are talking not just about Khartoum and Darfur. We are also including the three Kordofans. So it's like 9 states are still are in the vast danger of sexual violence related to conflicts inflicted upon them. On our recent update, we have 61 cases. That happens in Khartoum, which is 36 in Khartoum and 25 in West Darfur. But actually, we have numbers of what happened in West Darfur, and that's have been coming very much late because during the attacks on West Darfur, we don't have any kind of connection to the people. Most of our connections are restored after people have already moved to Chad. It's in Khartoum, all women are targeted, but mostly you find that little girls from the age of 12 to 16, 18, they are mostly targeted, especially when they're coming from African ethnicity. You see those people who are residing in underserved section come to buildings within each neighborhood, or they are just coming from impoverished families. They always been targeted. And even eyewitnesses could confirm there was the videotape that we provided for CNN. It was taped within the area where we protections committee cannot reach out for victims because mostly they are coming from very poor family. They're children, and they when they are even approached by helpers, they just run away because they are they have been very scared.
Besides age, the age groups these victims fall under. There are also reports that that refugee women, immigrants,
refugee women, immigrants
from South Sudan.
Yes, and even African ethnicity in Sudan, the Sudanese African ethnicity, and people who are affiliated more into African ethnicity, they are all targeted. Like houses of refugees in Khartoum and Omdurman and Bahri had been actually attacked, and people have and remove themselves afterwards. That's those attacks. We don't know where they go. The first victims were also Ethiopian refugees. there's also other nationalities involved sometimes. It will come in our reports. And women from South Sudan as well.
With the ongoing fighting and many hospitals being out of service and aid organizations unable to move around freely, where do victims of rape and sexual violence find help?
Okay, there's few, very few hospitals around Khartoum. Doctors who moved around from this hospital, actually they're doing it the impossible way. And they're doing it in the impossible way. Like they're moving from one hospital to another. They're trying to provide support as the minimum standard. Sometimes even victims cannot move out of their houses or premises. So they just prescribe the medications to them. And the medication is only the minimum standard. Like instead of the one pill that's used to prevent pregnancy, they are using contraceptives with certain dosage for each age. And then they're using antibiotics to stop transmitting of sexually transmitted diseases. But the antivirals, the other part of the protocol is not available because the medical supplies building is fully under the control of RSF. There's enough supplies stored over there, but they cannot receive them. So they're trying to get medications even from Medani or other ways. This is the situation. It's just providing the minimum standard, not more of that.
That's Suleyma Ishaq, Sudanese psychologist and trauma specialist. She's also director of Combating Violence Against Women, a department within Sudan's Ministry of Social Development. She spoke with Nabil Biajo from Sudan earlier today.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For more health news and medical breakthroughs, visit voaafrica.com. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Linor Mudu, in Washington, with producer Mukhbil Yabaro. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
Brings you the best in African music on the African Beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat and dumbolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays, or subscribe to the Encounter podcast. Just go to our homepage at voanews.com and click on Podcasts. Also, we love to hear from you. send an email to encounter@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielBOA and follow us on Twitter at CarolCastielBOA. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday